Pittsburgh Steelers Hall of Fame center Dermonte Dawson will be on the show today. He's going to give you some real insight into the Steelers offense under Chuck Knoll and Bill Cowher. He also pointed out details about what happens on the line of scrimmage and what the center's role is. Dermonte Dawson was ultra talented at center. He even ran to the outside at times, and he'll tell you how that made it into the Steelers playbook later on as well. In pro football today, we have a winner as of Thursday. The San Francisco 49ers have clinched the NFC West with a 10-4 record. You know, at the end of last year's NFC Championship game, if we would have said next year, hey, after 14 games, one of these teams will have clinched the division and the other will be in last place, would you have guessed it was the 49ers who would be in first place? And like I said last week, it's a real tribute to their offensive personnel adjusting to a third quarterback now, as well as the defense and the coaching staff. 49ers 2022 NFC West champions. Coming up on Sunday, the Lions at the Jets. I guess we could call this the Who Would Have Thunk It Bowl. Both teams with a chance at the playoffs. Sunday night, the Rams at Packers in the Whoa What Happened Bowl. Both teams with a combined 17 losses so far this year. I'm going to tell you what to look for the rest of the season and how that might help predict next year. I'm Jackson Michael. This is the Game Before the Money on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Also, check out the Game Before the Money podcast. Many annual college football awards were recently announced. You likely know that USC's Caleb Williams won the Heisman Trophy. How about some of the other awards? I've talked about the Outland Trophy throughout the year. That is the award for college football's best interior lineman. Before the season started, I told you three players to watch for who I thought had a great chance to win that Outland Trophy. They were Paris Johnson of Ohio State, Jalen Carter of Georgia, and Peter Skoronski of Northwestern. All three were named semifinalists. Like I've been saying, I'm not just goofing around here on the microphone. I'm not floating hot takes off the top of my head. I'm serious about this. Early in the college football season, I also told you to keep an eye on Michigan's Olusegun Oluwatimi, and Oluwatimi did indeed win the Outland Trophy. The Biletnikoff Award recognizes college football's best receiver and is named after Florida State and Oakland Raiders legend Fred Biletnikoff. Two of the semifinalists this year, Houston's Nathaniel Dell and North Carolina's Josh Downs, were players I told you to look out for before the season started. Jalin Hyatt of Tennessee won the award. Hyatt caught 15 touchdown passes this year, tied for tops in the nation with Nathaniel Dell. The Davey O'Brien Award was won by Max Duggan of TCU. He is the first TCU quarterback to win the award that is named after TCU quarterback Davey O'Brien. Duggan also won the Johnny Unitas Golden Arm Award. Texas running back Bijan Robinson won the Doak Walker Award, honoring the nation's best running back. Alabama's Will Anderson Jr. won his second straight Nagurski Award as the nation's best defensive player. He and Pat Fitzgerald are the only two-time recipients. Will Anderson Jr. also won the Chuck Bednarik Award, which also recognizes the nation's top defensive player. Iowa's Jack Campbell won the Butkus Award for the nation's best linebacker. Travius Hodges Tomlinson of TCU won the Jim Thorpe Award, honoring the nation's top defensive back. And Caleb Williams won the Maxwell Award for the best overall player. The Maxwell Award was first given out in 1937, only a couple of years after the first Heisman Trophy Award. The Heisman winner and Maxwell winner have been the same for the past few years, but sometimes they differ. And often when there are two or more front runners for the Heisman Trophy, and if your choice doesn't win the Heisman, often you'll be happy to note that that player won the Maxwell Award. A good example is in 2005, when there were a lot of differing opinions as to whether Vince Young or Reggie Bush should win the Heisman. Reggie Bush won the Heisman. Vince Young won the Maxwell Award. 1997 is another good example. Charles Woodson won the Heisman Trophy, and Peyton Manning won the Maxwell Award. A couple of weeks ago, the College Football Playoff announced that it's expanding to 12 teams in 2024. There will be at least one group of five team in the playoff, meaning a team from a non-Power 5 conference will get in every year, regardless of whether they finish in the top 12. If the format stays identical to what was announced, the top four teams will have a bye. Number 12 will play at number 5, either at the fifth-ranked team's home field or at a stadium selected by the fifth-ranked team. Number 11 will play at number 6, and so forth. Well, what would that look like this year? Let's take a look. The top four teams that are in the playoff, Georgia, Michigan, TCU, and Ohio State, would have a bye. Tulane is the highest ranked group of five team at number 16. Tulane would play at Alabama if the 12 team college football playoff started this year. 11th ranked Penn State would play at Tennessee. 10th ranked USC would play at Clemson, and 9th ranked Kansas State would play at Utah. How do those matchups compare with the current bowl season? Tulane will play USC in the Cotton Bowl. Alabama plays Kansas State in the Sugar Bowl. Penn State plays Utah in the Rose Bowl. Tennessee plays Clemson in the Orange Bowl. Fairly similar matchups. All the teams ended up playing against each other in one way or another. The only difference really being that no teams will advance. I like the Alabama against Kansas State matchup better than the hypothetical Tulane at Alabama game. For the most part though, the college football playoff that would have been this year if they use the 12-team format that they're putting in place in 2024. The matchups are, in my opinion, pretty similar in terms of team strength, although none of them are the same matchup that would have been under the expanded college football playoff. I've stated why I think the four-team playoff is best for determining a champion several times on this show, so I won't go into that again. But I did want to let you know what the 12-team playoff would look like this year. I will also post that on thegamebeforethemoney.com. Time for the crazy stat record of the week. The Division I college football record for most consecutive games rushing for 100 yards or more. We're talking about a single running back gaining 100 yards rushing. Most games in a row in Division I college football. What do you think the record is? Maybe 20 games? That's almost two seasons worth. But it's higher than that. 25 games? You're still low. The record is 31 games. Archie Griffin of Ohio State rushed for at least 100 yards for 31 straight games. The streak ran from September of 1973 until November of 1975. Archie Griffin won two Heisman trophies during that time. Remember, he is the only player to win the Heisman Trophy twice. And that string of 31 straight games of rushing for at least 100 yards is an indicator as to why that happened. When Archie Griffin's college career ended, he finished with the most career rushing yards of all time. Griffin's record stood only 1 year, as it was broken by Tony Dorsett in 1976. The 31 straight games record remains, however, as does Griffin's record of two Heisman trophies. Those were won consecutively in 1974 and 1975. To give you an idea of how great that record is, of 31 straight games with at least 100 yards rushing, the previous record was 18, held by Oklahoma Heisman Trophy winner Steve Owens. If you're wondering what the NFL record for most consecutive games rushing over 100 yards is, that is held by Barry Sanders with 14. Marcus Allen had previously held the record with 11. Chris Johnson is the only other player in NFL history to rush for more than 100 yards in 10 straight games. You can learn more facts about Archie Griffin's 31-game, 100-yard rushing streak, as well as many other great football history articles at thegamebeforethemoney.com. The Game Before the Money also has a Facebook page you can like and a YouTube channel. You can find The Game Before the Money on Twitter at Game Before Money and also on Instagram at Game Before Money. And of course, The Game Before the Money podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money, airing Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 Central on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Coming up, an interview with Steelers Hall of Famer Dermonte Dawson. The Cleveland Browns and Baltimore Ravens play this week. Now, this is a matchup that always brings a tinge of sadness because the Ravens are actually the original Cleveland Browns. You heard that right. The Baltimore Ravens were once the Cleveland Browns. Some of you might be old enough to remember this, but if you don't, the mid-1990s were a bit tough on NFL fans, at least for me. That was a time when you saw the Los Angeles Rams, Cleveland Browns, and Houston Oilers all move. For some reason, the Browns' move seemed to be the most stunning. Part of the reason was knowing that they had some of the most dedicated fans in the NFL. Another thing I remember was a Browns fan breaking down on national television and sobbing during an interview and then grasping for words. He just started to spew out his disdain for the Pittsburgh Steelers. That Browns-Steelers rivalry really was one of the best in the NFL at that time. And there's always a part of me that just feels that sense of loss when the Browns play the Ravens. Even though I'm not a Browns fan, they are not my team. But I certainly felt for Browns fans during that difficult time. And for a few seasons, from 1996 through 1998, there were no Cleveland Browns. Then in 1999, they started the whole team from scratch again as an expansion team, although all of the club records still remained as Cleveland Browns records. In the meantime, the franchise that was originally the Cleveland Browns, born in the AAFC during the 1940s, they moved to Baltimore and became the Baltimore Ravens. That was also a bit of a shock because Baltimore had lost the Colts, their beloved Colts, and felt the pain of that loss. When the Colts first moved from Baltimore, and before that, when the Raiders first moved from Oakland, I was too young to recognize that owners saw sports as a business. So while I've gotten older and understand that football is a business, you hear that all the time now. Whenever the Ravens and Browns play, it still sadly reminds me of that fact. The Browns moving to Baltimore, that was the move that made it seem like stark reality, at least to me. That was the move where I thought, wow, this could happen to any fan base. And I really felt for Browns fans, and I still do. The Browns started out the 1995 season with Bill Belichick in his fifth year as head coach. Yes, the Browns were coached by Bill Belichick. By the end of the season, the Browns were literally non-existent. There were no Cleveland Browns. They were added back as an expansion team, as I alluded to before. That was in 1999. Since then, the Browns have made the playoffs only twice, and they lost both playoff games. No team named the Cleveland Browns has ever been in the Super Bowl. The original Cleveland Browns franchise, founded by Arthur McBride and purchased in the 1960s by Art Modell, that's now known as the Baltimore Ravens. Since moving from Cleveland, the Ravens have been to the playoffs 13 times and have won the Super Bowl twice. In that time, the Browns have had 12 head coaches and the Ravens only three. The Ravens come into this week's game against the Browns tied for first place in the AFC North with a 9-4 record. The Browns are tied for last at 5-8. If you're an optimist, well, the Browns could still finish with a winning record at 9-8. We'll have to see. Let's talk about where we're at in the season and what I watch for. A few episodes ago, I mentioned that over the years, I've noticed that weeks 10 through 12 tend to be upset weeks in the NFL, or at least games where teams with losing records almost beat some of the best teams in the league. Now we're into what I call separation weeks. Some teams are pulling way ahead of the rest of their division. Look at Buffalo. They were tied at 8-3 with the Dolphins 2 weeks ago. Now the Bills are two games ahead of the Dolphins. The two teams play each other this week in Buffalo. If Buffalo wins that, they'll be three games ahead. And if Miami wins, they'll still be down a game. Even though there are a few weeks left in the regular season, the dust has at least started to clear up. Before week one, I told you a little bit about what I saw in the NFC North. First, I thought that this was the year that Minnesota could knock off the Packers off the top of the NFC North. Second, I mentioned how important the week one Packers at Minnesota game was in terms of actually doing that, because the teams don't play again until the second to last week of the season. The Vikings have basically ran away with that division after defeating the Packers in week one. And then a few weeks later, I mentioned to play close attention to the Vikings game against the Eagles, because that could likely determine some playoff seedings. The Eagles won that game and now sit two games ahead of Minnesota and own the tiebreaker over the Vikings when it comes to being the number one seed in the NFC. Where things stand right now, the Eagles are basically three games ahead of Minnesota by owning that tiebreaker. The reason why I go back to what I said in previous weeks is because the reason why I wanted to do this show was to kind of point out the arc of the entire season. I just mentioned the Eagles tiebreaker over Minnesota. Here's another team with tiebreakers, the Detroit Lions, and they are in a hunt for a playoff spot. How about that? They're a little bit behind the Giants and Commanders right now, but listen up. The Lions beat both of those teams already and own the tiebreaker over both of them. That's what I meant when I say early games matter. Detroit beat Washington in week two, but it could still determine which of those teams makes the playoffs. And that's why I'm saying when you watch the entire regular season like this, it is a beautiful thing. And I'll use the Lions as an example for another thing I look for at this point in the season. I'm looking for clues for next year. Detroit has won 5 out of their last 6. If they finish strong, then I'm going to look for them to, I know this sounds crazy, but to possibly have a solid year next year. This year, Detroit started 1-6. But as of right now, all 6 of those losses were against teams that would be in the playoffs if they started today. How are they going to finish? Are they going to finish like a team that might make a push next year? I'm also looking at the Falcons and the Jaguars in that regard. Again, I know it sounds crazy, but if one of those teams finishes strong and turns out to be a surprise team next year, you're going to be able to enjoy that knowing that you saw that coming the year before. And I'll give you some good examples of it. The Eagles won 6 out of their last 8 last year after they started 3-6. They only won 4 games the season before that. But if you were paying attention last year during the win streak, you could see the improvement. They even made the playoffs. And now where are they at? That's right. They got the best record in football. Let's look at Miami. Last year, they started 2-7. Brian Flores turned that team around, winning 8 out of their last 9. And then he was fired. Hard to find a guy in NFL history who was fired after winning 8 of his last 9 games. But that's another story for another day. If you were paying attention, you could see that Miami had a good shot at making the playoffs this year. And then they added Tyreek Hill. So then you could really see it coming. These weeks are going to give you clues as to what teams to look out for to make a run at it next year. The Jets are another team to watch. They had a great start, then lost 3 out of their last 4. How are they going to finish? That can indicate what they're going to do next year. And it can also indicate who might surprise a few people in the playoffs this year. The Bengals are an excellent example of that. They were 7-6 after 13 games last year, then won 3 out of 4 to just barely make the playoffs. And yet, they still won the AFC. The year before, the Bengals won 2 out of their last 3. So pay attention to how teams finish this season, whether they're in the race or not. You might get a better sense of how things could shape up next year and even possibly the year after. And don't forget to pay attention to teams that bottom out, contenders that kind of disappear. That can be a signal that a team might take a downturn next season. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. Also, check out the Game Before the Money podcast, wherever you get your podcasts. It's very rare that a team has a Hall of Famer leave after a long tenure with the franchise, and he is followed by another Hall of Famer that will be with the franchise for a very long time. The Pittsburgh Steelers enjoyed that situation at center with Mike Webster holding that spot from the mid-70s through 1988. Dermonte Dawson then moved from guard to center and stayed there for the Steelers until 2000. Dermonte Dawson grew up in Kentucky and played college football at the University of Kentucky. The Steelers drafted Dawson in the 2nd round of the 1988 NFL Draft. He played guard his first year with the Steelers and then moved to center. He'll tell you the story behind that in just a moment as we discuss his time with the Steelers. The full interview will be posted soon on the Game Before the Money podcast. Here's Steelers Hall of Fame center, Dermonte Dawson.
you came into the Steelers as a second round pick in 88, and they started playing you at guard.
Yeah. Well, hey, Michael, I was originally a pulling guard at University of Kentucky as well. And then, you know, how I became center is because I used to go to a scout team at UK and go against the number one offense. And so I played a little center throughout college. And then they switched me to defensive line, I think my junior year, and wanted me to play defensive tackle. And this was in spring ball when they made that switch. And then they switched me back to guard at the end of spring practice. But, you know, I was a pulling guard, but I used to play center for the scout team. And then also in the bowl game, we played against Wisconsin in the Hall of Fame bowl game down in Mobile, Alabama. And this was in 87, I think it was. And they switched me to center because our center went down and I was starting to guard at that time. So I did have some experience, you know, playing center just for the scout team.
Yeah. And in a bowl game, too.
Yeah. And then, you know, when I came to Pittsburgh in 88, you know, they drafted me originally as a guard. And then, you know, of course, you had Mike Webster, who was the center, and I played beside Mike. But I didn't start until my fourth game of my rookie year. I finished out the year after I got hurt, and I was on IR because I got my knee hurt my rookie year. And then I only started 8 games my rookie year at guard. But after my rookie season, then Chuck Knoll, they called me into his office and said, you know, we want to switch you to center because Mike was leaving to go to Kansas City. Chuck Knoll just took me in the office and said, hey, I'm just going to switch you to center and let you and Chuck Lanza kind of fight it out for the position. I ended up winning the job.
The center is kind of the quarterback of the offensive line. I've heard other people say that as well. Can you kind of walk us through what you're looking for when you line up at the center and you know, for a typical play?
Yeah. You know, just say for instance, a pass play, you know, usually our protection, our responsibility as an O-line is, you know, the four big guys, defensive tackle, you know, ends, and then also the Mike linebacker kind of dictates because he's right in the middle and he's a clear and present danger right in the middle if you were to blitz. So when you come up to the line of scrimmage, you know, we have base calls where you have like slide protections where you slide one way and the back is blocking the opposite direction. Or you have like a quick pass where we're responsible for the four big guys on the line of scrimmage and the middle linebacker. So we have to make various calls when we go up there based on the alignment of the middle backer, which is a Mike linebacker, we call him. And then also the configuration of the defensive line, whether they're in an over or an under defense. And an over defense being stacked towards the tight end, under defense is being on the open side of the offense where the tight end's on the opposite side. So it depends on what kind of pass play is called. And so our responsibilities are based on, you know, whether it's a quick pass or slide protection. So we have to make all those adjustments. And sometimes we come up to the line of scrimmage and then they've got a different defense where we're kind of outmanned as far as protection-wise. So the quarterback has to call an audible. And so we have to know what that audible means. And there's different rules based on whatever pass it is. If it's a quick pass or a play action pass, we have different rules for different passes. And so you just have to be astute on making sure that you know exactly what your responsibility is because it changes. The back's responsibility, who he will block, and also the offensive line. So, and then a quarterback's got to know that if you got a guy coming off the corner, then he has to be aware that we call it like hot. So because he has no protection, he's got to identify that guy himself and get rid of the ball. So that's kind of like what you look for when you come up to the line of scrimmage as a center.
Yeah, that's really interesting because a lot of people, you know, it's really well known that the quarterback is up there reading the defense, but the center has defensive reading responsibilities as well, then it sounds like.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, you know, we practice a lot of that stuff too. We come up with different calls just to alert people. And sometimes you have to echo that to the back. Sometimes you have to make sure that you convey it up and down the line to the tackle and the tight end's got to hear it as well. So we just got to identify who our protection is or who we're responsible for. So yeah, you have to, you know, I know a lot of people always talk about, you know, you have to be dumb jocks, but when you're playing football, you can't be dumb. You got to know and be able to identify and make a split decision very quickly when you get up to the line of scrimmage.
I've spoken to some other people about the 70s Steelers. I've heard that a lot of their scheme on the offensive line was trap blocking. Was it still like that when you got in there, or what was the scheme like?
It was a trap blocking scheme. Tom Moore was the offensive coordinator at that time, and they did have a trapping offense, back in the 70s, because they had smaller linemen and quick linemen. So that was just a style of offense that Tom Moore ran, with the trap plays, counter traps, draw plays. And a lot of teams don't do the trapping offense anymore. It's more off-tackle running, dive plays and toss sweeps. And now it's more of a passing offense now, because it's more of high-scoring games now, the way the offenses are structured.
And did that change happen while you were in the league? You played from, the late 80s to 2000.
No, it really, for us, we had an identity as a running team, we're more of a running, downhill running team. I always call it smash mouth football. And, we identified with the run game because we were going to run the ball at all cost. And that's what most offensive linemen like to do. You want to run and establish dominance over defense. Sometimes you get beat, but you still got to try to establish that dominance as a run team, because it wears defenses down, and then also it keeps the defense off the field, so the defense can be effective, keeping their offense off the field. So it's a give and take kind of offense, and it's just a mindset, man. It's that worker's mentality kind of football, smash mouth football.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you always hear about controlling the line of scrimmage. Now, is that something, is that like game momentum too, where there's momentum throughout the game? Or does it change every play? Or is it just something that kind of happens over the course of the game where you guys take over the defensive?
Yeah. It kind of happens, from the start of the game, because you come with your game plan, and the coordinator, he has about 15 to 20 plays that we're going to run that we run very well. And so you kind of build that momentum, trying to feel out the defense and making adjustments to whatever schemes they're doing. And as an offensive line, you want to assert your dominance over your opponent. And it becomes a mentality, a physical mentality. You're going to force your will on somebody else who's trying to do the same to you. But hopefully we prevail. And so it's a momentum thing, as you have some success in a running game, and you just continue to try to grind that ball out and eat up that clock.
One thing I noticed about you playing center that's different than most anybody I've seen is a lot of times you were almost pulling like a guard and blocking downfield. Did they develop that with you, or was that something that developed over your career, or how did that come into play?
Yeah, hey, Jackson, that started in 1992 when Bill Cowher came as head coach his first year. And, and this kind of happened in training camp. We would always take the first Monday of the week and work and try to incorporate our first game planning. So that first Monday or first day of practice in training camp, we'd focus on our first game of the season. So we were playing, I think it was Philly or something. We were going to play our first game of the season. And so they were going to this new defense, like a 4-4 defense, where they had four linebackers, four defensive defenders, defensive linemen. And so they're playing gaps. So it was wreaking havoc with the offensive line being able to make it up to the second level to block the linebackers. And it was driving teams crazy. So I was in camp one day, and I told Ron Earhart, who was the offensive coordinator at that time, I said, Ron, I can make a call, and I can have the guard either block my assignment depending on how wide he is, and then I can pull as a center and go around and take his responsibility. And so we started to do that and kind of fool with it in practice to see how it would go. And after we ran it a few times, and I told Ron too that I would make calls, either a live call or a false call, just to let those guys know and kind of communicate it, because we all have to be on the same page, because you don't want to let a guy, you know, free in the backfield to kill the running back. So we started doing that in 92, and we just kept fooling with it in training camp, and we started incorporating it in more and more of the offense. And, you know, that became our signature thing, me pulling from the center position.
Yeah, wow. And that was a signature part of your career, and that's really interesting. So it kind of started as an adjustment for one game, it sounds like, and then you guys just hung with it.
And then we stuck with it because we were so effective, and you know, people couldn't stop us running the ball because they couldn't shade a guy and take up two linemen and then allow the linebacker to kind of do his own thing freestyle where he's unblocked. And you know, so we started incorporating in our offense, man. And I tell you what, you know, and then people tried to mimic the same thing as the blocking schemes that we were running.
Fantastic insight from Hall of Fame center Dermonte Dawson of the Pittsburgh Steelers. Insights about the game that you won't hear anywhere else. The full interview will be posted after the new year on the Game Before the Money podcast. I will keep you updated. If you are a Steelers fan, you'll still want to check out the Game Before the Money podcast before then. Episode 63 with the great Jack Ham sharing stories. And then episode 47 about that great Pittsburgh Steelers draft of 1974. Charlie Davis, who was a member of that draft class, is on that podcast, as well as Steelers assistant coach Lionel Taylor. And also on that podcast is Vito Stellino, the great writer who covered the Steelers in the 70s. I'm Jackson Michael. This is The Game Before the Money. Visit thegamebeforethemoney.com. The Game Before the Money airs Saturday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern, 8 Pacific, on the Sports Map Radio Network and the Sports Map Radio app. Very special thanks to Dermonte Dawson for that interview. A lot of great stuff there. And, you know, the center position, it doesn't get a lot of credit for being kind of the quarterback of the offensive line. The first I really heard of that was when I got to chat with the late, great Courtney Hall at his induction to the Southwest Conference Hall of Fame. He told me about the interaction that he would have with Stan Humphries, the Chargers quarterback, at the line of scrimmage. There's a lot more to the center position than just hiking the ball on the right count. Pay attention when you watch games this week and see if you can see what centers are doing at the line of scrimmage. Okay, time for our Hall of Famer of the Week, spotlighting a member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame that you might not know much about. This week is Leo Namalini, defensive tackle for the San Francisco 49ers for 14 seasons from 1950 through 1963. He was named the greatest defensive tackle in the first 50 years of the NFL. He also played offensive line and was named All-NFL on both offense and defense. He was born in Italy, immigrated to Chicago at a very young age, and didn't play high school football because he needed to work a job to help support the family. He joined the Marines during World War II. It was in the Marines that he first played football. He played college football at Minnesota and was drafted in the first round of the 1950 NFL draft by the San Francisco 49ers. He played in 174 consecutive games, which set an NFL record for the time. Leo Namalini is a true great that every fan should know about. He was inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame in 1969. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Game Before the Money. I'm Jackson Michael. Please visit thegamebeforethemoney.com.